you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
It will be royals, royals. It can run in our blood. The kind of looks just same for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler, ruler. You can call me Queen Bee. And baby, I'll rule, I'll rule, I'll rule, I'll rule. Let me live that fantasy.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? You're listening to the Command Zone podcast. / watching it on youtube.com/TheCommandZonePodcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
It's that time.
It is that time. Modern Horizons is almost here. Oof. And that means we are going to be unveiling our exclusive, provided to us free of charge from Wizards of the Coast, preview cards.
Preview card.
I don't know. They
I
tell
thought
us
you were going to hype up what it was.
They always tell us, you got to say that. I don't know
it's
why.
True. It's true. Free of charge.
Yes, this card that I'm holding in my hand, they did not charge us for it.
It is absurd, and I cannot wait to talk about it. In fact, it may just be, you thought Feather was cool.
Listen, we had Vanifar before that.
Yep.
And I would say, I'm pretty certain this, it's a legendary creature, by the way, is the most powerful of those three cards. By a decent margin.
I'd say more than a decent margin. We've never had a commander card that I think could easily enter into CEDH territory, and one...
This one absolutely does. It's
knocks it out of the park.
It's possibly too powerful, but...
Yeah. And now, if you're going to want to pre-order this card, or any of the other cards from Modern Horizons, you should head on over to cardkingdom.com/commandzone. That's our affiliate link. Modern Horizons is going to be an amazing set, I can already tell, based on the things that we've seen, and I think you're going to want a lot of those cards, so you're going to buy them anyway. Use our affiliate link, you'll support the show.
Yeah, or you can order the cards that are going to go in this Urza deck, whether you're building the very mean version or maybe a more fun version.
Wow, you just spoiled the name of the card.
Oh, yeah, it's Urza. Sorry. Oh,
well,
if
Urza.
You skipped ahead, you wouldn't even know the name yet.
You wouldn't even know.
Well, although they'd skip ahead to the part where we're saying the name again, so it wouldn't matter.
That's a good point.
When you do order those cards... There, a lot of them are probably not going to be super, super cheap. You know, they might be worth a few dollars. So you want to protect them. So you're going to want to put them into an Ultra Pro Eclipse sleeve. You're going to want to make sure that you play them onto a sweet play mat so they don't get all dirty. You know, you don't want to just play it on the sidewalk like
we used to
as kids.
The
so,
gravel.
Yeah, make sure that you use Ultra Pro products to protect and organize all of your cards. They are the best.
And the final way to support the show, of course, is at patreon.com/commandzone. That is how you can be a patron of the show. You can join our Discord server where we discuss spoilers like these and as well as brew. You can get help from other players as well as talk to Josh and I directly online. And we do one special thing every episode where we shout out one lucky patron. So this week's episode is dedicated to
Michael Davignon. Michael, you rock.
You do rock.
We both did the D'Artagnan thing. Yeah. I don't know. It could go either way. It
one
could
for
be
all.
Davignon, too.
All for one.
Yeah. All right, let's jump into our main topic. I know you're all chomping at the bit to see what our preview card is. Jimmy?
Oh, boy, it's me?
That was a drum roll. Just in case people didn't know.
I thought you were just clearing your throat. The card that we are previewing for Modern Horizons is a mythic rare. It is Urza, Lord High Artificer. Urza is back, and boy, is he
and
more powerful
than
ever.
Way badder than ever, yeah.
Yeah, two blue for a legendary creature, human artificer. He's a 1/4.
There's a lot of text, so just pay attention.
There are three main pieces of text here. The first piece of text, when Urza, Lord High Artificer, enters the battlefield, create a 0/0 colorless construct artifact creature token with this creature gets +1/+1 for each artifact you control. The second line of text, tap an untapped artifact you control, add a blue mana. The third line of text, because 2 wasn't enough, 5 generic mana, shuffle your library, then exile the top card. Until end of turn, you may play that card without paying his mana cost.
So 5 generic mana, colon, do that.
Yeah.
So if you have 10 generic mana or 10 mana of any color, basically, You shuffle your library, exile the top card, play it without paying its mana cost, then do that again.
Yeah. And how are you going to ever pay for that much?
Yeah,
that's five. It's so much mana. There's only a way that you had a card that helped gain you more mana.
Yeah, if only Urza made all your artifacts into Moxen.
Including the one that he comes into the battlefield with.
That's right.
Which becomes a big creature over time, too.
So at a base level, he's a 4-mana 1/4 that brings a mana rock with him.
Yeah. That may be huge, could also attack, but more importantly, can also tap for mana without needing to be have haste.
Oh, yeah. It's like a zombie, right?
Yeah.
Where it doesn't give the artifact the ability to tap for mana. It says tap an untapped artifact you control, add blue. So that's like a downside. It's like Urza's tapping the thing to add the mana. So
yeah.
It doesn't require... Summoning Sickness doesn't matter.
Yeah, the creature that you put onto the battlefield, you can tap it because Urza is the one that has the activated ability to do that.
Yeah, it's...
Wow.
Wow is very right. So... I'm gonna tell a little story. It's a slight spoiler. Obviously, the next Game Nights is going to be around Modern Horizons.
Yes.
I don't think that's going to surprise anyone. What happens normally for Game Nights is we choose the guests, and if you've been paying attention, you'll know that it's Graham and Kathleen from Loading Ready Run. And then we show, you know, all the legendary creatures in the set to everybody, and we say to the guests, you choose first, and Jimmy and I will choose from what remains.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out that we won't spoil what the... we don't know what cards have been spoiled at this point.
Yeah.
But it turns out that I got Urza at the end of this. I chose Urza. Because I was like, this looks pretty powerful. I'll build this.
Pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as I started to build it, I called Jimmy into my office. And I was like, Jimmy, I gotta change. Because I can't play this. Because this is ridiculous. This will destroy every other... deck at the table.
It will destroy most decks in EDH if built correctly.
Yeah, I we're going to talk about this a little near the end, but yeah, it's definitely CEDH level, competitive level. I would be very, very surprised if this is not like a tier 1 or 1.5
yeah.
commander. So WoW was the first thing we thought when we saw it. I mean, I thought it was going to be powerful, but as I started to put it together, it became clear that it's very powerful.
Well, I even was like, well, can you build it in a subpar way? And it was like, not really.
It seemed hard to do that. I think you probably could. It's tough for us to on game nights because people will just be like, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? In general, we like to build like a pretty good version of the deck and a good version of Urza. It feels broken.
It's just far more powerful than any of the other options we had. And we looked at it and we thought about it for a while and it was very clear that Urza is just bonkers powerful compared to the rest.
But the good part of this is that I got a fair way into building that deck. And so we're going to actually talk about some of the things you can do with this commander if you do want to build it. So the first category, this won't be a full deck tech, but it's going to be definitely more in-depth than our normal preview episode. Although I suppose with Feather, we kind of did a similar thing. Maybe we're just doing this now. I don't know.
Hey, look, if Wizards is going to provide us with a card like this, we are going to be excited about it. I don't know anything about Modern, by the way, and I'm sure the implications of this card in Modern are also somewhat significant, but in EDH, this is going to be a whammy of a card.
Yeah. Okay, so the first category is Cheerios.
Cheerio.
Because there are a ton of zero mana cost artifacts. Now, most of them don't do a lot,
mm-hmm.
but Cheerios is a deck. Anybody that runs a SRAM deck knows there's a bunch of equipment that costs zero. There's
Bonesaw.
Think of like a Quarter Shield, Kite Shield. There's a bunch of cards like this, and they're all zero mana. So you play those, then when Urza's out, they're literally Mox Sapphire Plus.
Yeah, a card that is very banned in EDH.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good.
If you just like, hey, I'm going to turn all like 20 cards in my deck into Moxes.
I have this 25-cent card called a Quarter Shield, and with Urza, it becomes one of the most powerful cards ever printed.
It becomes a $9,000 card.
Yeah, ever printed in the history of Magic. Yeah, so Cheerios comes from the name, obviously, of when you see the card, it says zero at the top right. Looks like a Cheerio. Thus, it is. There have been decks built around this sort of thing. Wes played a SRAM deck on game nights, and you could see how powerful it was because his commander let him draw cards when he played in equipment. Or an artifact like that. So he would just basically cycle all of these cards. Urza just turns them all into mana rocks. Colored mana rocks, no less.
And also SRAM had that sort of restriction in that it had to be equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Urza doesn't care. It's just artifacts. So there's a bunch of zero mana artifacts that are still going to be Moxen. And actually, some of them are useful. There's a bunch of zero mana artifacts that are like, you wouldn't really run the card all by itself. But with the upside of it's also a mana rock, you definitely would. So there's like Tormod's Crypt.
Yeah.
which is, you know, a graveyard hoser. There's like
a card you would normally not really play because there are other better options to hose graveyards.
But like if you're like, well, sometimes it's mana.
Yeah.
then you 100% run it. There's like Zurin Orb, which is life gain. You sacrifice lands to gain life.
Yeah, usually only seen in like Omnath decks. Yep. But now all of a sudden it becomes a multi-utility artifact.
There's Spellbook, which just reliquary towers for your hand, basically. Again, not a card you would play because that's not worth a card by itself. But when it's zero mana, man, I keep doing that.
Wow, you keep doing that. For those of you listening, Josh is unable to toss a piece of paper.
It took me three tries to get the table. I think I caught that from DJ.
Dark Sphere is another card I didn't even know existed. It's from the dark. Normally, it's just an artifact that costs zero. You tap it, and you prevent damage from a source. The next time that source would deal damage, you prevent half of it.
It's like a half fog for one thing. It's pretty bad.
It's
awful. But if it also taps for mana, it's a Moxen that does that.
And in general, you'll find that CEDH decks play like 7 to 8 zero mana cost cards, all of the different Moxes that do exist that you can play.
The Chrome Moxes, the Mox Diamonds, and all that stuff,
And now we just have all, you basically have access to an additional like 8 to 10 of them that you could easily play in this deck. And so that's why we think that the CEDH implications of this are very powerful. Now, of course, you have to cast Urza first, otherwise you're just playing these zero drop artifacts. But once Urza's out,
We learn from how priority works. If Urza doesn't get countered, you're going to get to tap all those artifacts for mana.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be a time in there to respond. At least, you know, even if they go to swords it, you're going to get the mana off the rocks one time at least.
Yeah.
There's also a bunch... The next category I called plus mana rock. So think of all your artifacts with static abilities. They become that plus mana rock, right? So you're looking at like Torpor Orb.
Yeah, creatures entering the battlefield don't cause abilities to trigger, which is very relevant, very important in EDH in general.
Sometimes it can feel like not worth an entire card in your deck because you don't know.
Yeah.
Although I'll say Torpor Orb always like hoses decks. But at the same time, like now it also taps for mana, so you can just afford to have it in there.
Yeah, it would, just the utility. I mean, like, again, the card itself doesn't tap for mana. Urza has an ability that allows you to tap the artifact for mana. So don't think that the card itself has that text. You need to have Urza out for it. But Meekstone, again, another great card that is able to stop creatures with power 3 or greater that don't untap during their controller's untap step. And of course, we do know that snow-covered lands are going to be in Modern Horizons. And one of my favorite cards in my mono red deck is Extra Planar Lens. And normally this card is very dangerous, right? It's a 3-mana artifact that comes out. You have to exile a land under it. So you do lose a land.
Two for ones you when you do it. Yeah.
But then all your lands tap for all your snow covered lands, in this case, would tap for double mana. And you're doing that because other players aren't playing snow covered basics. Now Extra Planar Lens doesn't 2-for-1 you as much because that card taps for mana.
It's also a mana rock.
It's a 3-mana, it's a 3-mana mana rock, which is...
It's like Chromatic Lantern if Chromatic Lantern said all your lands tap for double rather than the other thing.
Yeah.
That should be way better, right? It's like Mirari's Wake Plus. That Extra Planar Lens trick, if you haven't heard of it, you should look it up with snow-covered basics. Although it might not be as great right now right when Modern Horizons comes out, I'm assuming a lot of people are going to put a bunch of snow-covered lands in their decks just for novelty because they look cool.
I mean, I would, I like the look of them in general, but they, you know, the original ones cost a decent amount, and trying to outfit all of your lands as that, it's not worth it, especially in like 3-color decks.
Yeah.
But in monocolor decks, Extra Planar Lands is one of the really great ways to just like jump ahead in terms of your mana.
There's stuff like Black Vice, which taxes people for having too many cards in hand. Ankh of Mishra, which does damage when people play lands. There's a really mean one too, Winter Orb, which would be...
Winter Orb may be the best, because the card, if it's tapped, doesn't have its ability. But
yes,
with Urza, you can instant-speed tap it. So you can lock everyone else's lands down, but keep yours alive.
Winter Orb is mean. Yeah, because Winter Orb says players can only untap one land per turn. Two things here. One is you don't need your lands as much because all your Cheerios artifacts are tapping for mana, and artifacts untap just fine. And two, like Jimmy said, there's errata on Winter Orb. If you see one of the early versions, it doesn't say this. But if Winter Orb is tapped, it doesn't have that effect. So if you just tap it on the end step before your turn, then you get to untap all your lands.
Yeah.
And nobody else does. This also works with like Howling Mine, which doesn't draw people extra cards if it's tapped. So you can tap it for mana and then it untaps on your untap phase and you just draw the extra card.
Yeah, normally those cards are pretty... That part of the text is almost never relevant.
Yeah.
Sometimes people do make their decks to abuse Winter Orb, but like whenever you play Howling Mine, I'm never expecting that thing to get tapped.
Yep. There's even cards like Ichor Wellspring, which just draws you a card when it comes into play and normally is not that much value. But think of how good Mindstone is, right?
Yeah.
Mind Stone, you have to sacrifice it. This draws you a card when it comes into play and then taps for mana. Again, assuming Urza's out. Already we're in the realm of like insanely powerful, because whenever you're playing around with one of the two pillars we always talk about, card draw and or ramp, you are in dangerous territory. And this is ramp on steroids.
You being the danger, not...
you being the card designer.
Yeah, you are the danger. I mean, look, I don't know who designed this card, but part of me goes, why?
Yeah.
Because
Well, hold on. We're going to get into that later. We're going to get into that later.
All right.
We're still talking about cool things you can do, because there are a lot. Clues and treasure tokens.
Yeah, all of a sudden, they become
much
more valuable.
You don't sack them anymore.
Yeah, and the clues themselves are just great, because you can turn them into card draw, or you can just use them for mana with Urza out.
Gold as well, although there's less of that. So obviously, right. Like Spell Swindle. Spell Swindle is crazy if you pull it off. But imagine if Mana Drain just gave you that mana every turn.
Yeah, and you could choose if you didn't want to use the Spell Swindle tokens to like tap them for mana.
You're just like, so when I Spell Swindle your 7-drop, now I just have 7 extra mana rocks.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not winning on that next turn, and I assume the CEDH decks will ramp out Urza as fast as they can, drop a ton of cards with Cheerios.
They're not going to even play Spell Swindle. It's too expensive for
them. That's too expensive. You're just playing a bunch of stuff, and then all of a sudden on turn 3 or 4, you have access to... I don't know, like 8 to 15 mana probably.
It could be an insane amount.
Yeah.
So there's cards like Confirm Suspicions, which counters a spell, makes 3 clues. There's Trail of Evidence, which is a enchantment. Anytime you cast an instant or sorcery.
You investigate.
Yep, you make a clue token. So now anytime you cast an instant or sorcery, you brainstorm and you go, I make a mana rock. a mana rock. We pay 2 mana for those.
Yeah.
In monocolor decks, we play as many of them as of the 2 mana ones as we can get.
Not to mention they don't add colored mana.
Right.
So a lot of times if people are trying to go...
Some do, Felwar Stone.
Right. But if people are trying to go infinite with like a Palancron, one of the big things is like, oh crap, I don't have enough blue to recast Palancron. I can make infinite colorless or whatever. Urza gets right around that.
Hornswoggle is another card that counters a creature spell and makes treasure, and again... It becomes a mini mana drain when you do stuff like that. Yeah. Like, it's pretty crazy.
Tameo's Journal, too, if you're playing a lot of clues, can also just start tutoring for you, but also you're making a mana rock every turn. And getting to 5 mana in this deck, I think, is not an issue whatsoever. So there's a lot of things that happen here with Urza that are just absurd.
Plus,
we haven't even talked about his third ability, by the way.
Yeah, this is just the tapping artifacts for mana part. And we're not done yet. There are artifact payoffs. So, like, Efficient Construction is an enchantment that anytime you cast, or is it cast?
Cast
an artifact, you create a Thopter token, which is an artifact, which taps for more mana.
Which also makes, by the way, it's not completely irrelevant that the creature that comes into the battlefield gets bigger every single time you play an artifact.
That's
so
true. You get one creature that's basically as big as the number of artifacts you have.
Yeah, it could be like a 7-7 on turn 3 or whatever and just start smacking people for a lot of damage as well.
Even bigger than that.
Oh, totally.
Because if you cast Urza, hold your artifacts, and then, you know, go blah, 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 somewhere in there, cast Efficient Construction.
Right.
You could have 9-10 artifacts easy.
Yeah. Another card that I really like from M19, the core set, is Psy, Master Thopterist. And he's the same as Efficient Construction. Whenever you cast an artifact, you make a 1-1 colorless Thopter. But the other ability, 1 in the blue to sacrifice 2 artifacts, and then you draw a card. You can tap for that 1 in the blue with the 2 artifacts you sack. Pretty good. Or with the art, yeah.
The two artifacts, yeah. The artifact you're going to sack, you can tap it first for mana.
Yeah.
There's Riddlesmith that lets you loot when I think artifacts come into play. There's Thopter Spy Network that, again, is card draw and makes artifacts. There's
Thopter Spy Network is great in this.
There's Antiquities War, which is the saga from Dominaria that turns all of your artifacts into 5/5s.
Right.
So once you've gone through all of that, you could maybe get to that point.
Yeah.
And that could be maybe a win condition in the deck to turn all the artifacts, the 50 million artifacts you made into...
Well, not to mention the first 2 phases are you revealing artifacts and you're finding them from the top cards of your library. So you are going to be drawing cards off of this as well.
Yeah, this is pretty nuts already, right? And we're talking about, you might be surprised to know, that we haven't even gotten into what I consider to be the really broken, powerful stuff.
Yeah, we're just talking about the cutesy stuff we're doing right now.
Yeah.
And just the efficiency of all of it.
Some of this would be the basis in a competitive, more competitive style deck, but this is also stuff that could be in the quote-unquote fun version, except for maybe Winter Orb.
Fun version? I don't think there is a fun version of this deck.
But we're going to talk about the more powerful stuff you can do in a minute. We're just going to take a quick break before that and hear a message from our sponsors.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, we're back and we are talking about our preview card from Modern Horizons, Urza, Lord High Artificer. We sort of just ran down all the... how would you say the
value based slash cool interactions slash ways to make this work more smoothly in your deck?
Fun stuff.
Fun, yeah. It's cool, I mean, it's all fun. Powerful to the right
stuff,
person, right?
Yeah. Now we're gonna talk about the broken stuff you can do, and I'll admit I didn't go down the road here totally. I just started to saw where the path was leading and was like, okay, I'm sure you can do a bunch of this broken stuff.
You started to feel bad about yourself, right? You're like, oh boy.
I was like, that was the point at which I was like, I gotta change what I'm building. So I didn't like finish like tweaking, but we're just gonna mention some possibilities of stuff you could do in here, and I'm sure the CEDH people and everybody else will figure out
the
specifics
best,
of tweaking it to like the most highly tuned. And again, listen, I got in trouble a little on Twitter recently for even mentioning infinite combos. So to that one person, I apologize. But it kind of is within our job.
Wait, who's the one person? Never mind.
It's kind
Let's
of within our job here to just lay out the possibilities. I don't tell people how to play. Play how you want to play. Just make sure that if you see Urza on the table, you should know what's possible also.
Well, for one, this commander is kill on sight. I think of all. I mean, Vanifar sure too, but Urza immediately goes into effect even without haste enablers. The question is Urza Paradox Engine level good?
I think so. I think it's better than Vanifar by a little bit because Vanifar...
Not just a little bit, a lot.
Yeah, by a lot. Because Vanifar has to get an activation off, and with Summoning Sickness, there's a natural check on that. Urza could go off the turn you cast it fairly easily. So, yeah, is it Paradox Engine good? Oh, sorry. I killed your lead-in.
No, it's... Well, clearly the first broken thing you can do with this card is just play Paradox Engine.
Paradox Engine untaps all your artifacts every time you cast a spell, and all your artifacts are... zero cost artifacts, you're gonna have 50 of them.
Yeah, you can just go bam, tap, and generate. You could, I don't know, I bet there's a way you can get like 50 mana or infinite mana by turn three with this card.
Plus, Urza has a mechanic that's close to card draw on it.
Yeah.
So you can sort of get yourself out of some corners you might get into otherwise where you just don't have gas.
Yeah.
Urza can help you get out of that with that last ability.
I mean, you generate infinite mana, you can play your entire deck essentially.
And Paradox Engine will help you get infinite mana. And there's a thing I want to talk about here. The mono blue is really, 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 really good at getting an artifact into play, a specific artifact. They're probably the best color at it. So to put this in mono blue and make Paradox Engine such a key linchpin in the deck, it's not going to be hard if you want to get Paradox Engine. So this is the suite of cards that you can run to make sure you can get Paradox Engine into play. War of Invention, which is instant speed, mm-hmm. also uses your artifacts to cast it,
yeah.
even without Urza out. Reshape requires you to, I think, sacrifice an artifact to get one into play. There's Transmute Artifacts, same sort of deal. There's Fabricate, another tutor for an artifact. You can use Kuldotha Forge Master, which is a little bit slower, but can sacrifice three artifacts and go tutor for artifacts. This is something that, I mean, there's five cards. So you can basically, just right there, have six copies of Paradox Engine in your deck.
Yeah, you're pretty much building the deck right now if you're going for the full competitive level. It's basically, how do we ramp Urza out? And once he's out, how do we get cards like Paradox Engine out? And then after that, how are you going to win the game with that?
Yeah.
You basically get to choose, right? There are a lot of different ways of doing it, but obviously this is... God, it's so powerful. I'm so unhappy.
There's another
this.
Very commonly used infinite combo.
Combo,
which is Dramatic Reversal, which is one in a blue for an instant, and you untap all non-land permanents you control.
True.
And then Isochron Scepter, when you play it, you can...
You exile a CMC spell two or less.
Instant, two or less. And it kind of imprints it onto Isochron's Scepter, and then you can basically pay two, tap the Scepter, and cast that spell. And so with Dramatic Reversal under Isochron's Scepter, you can go infinite because Dramatic Reversal untaps the Isochron's Scepter.
And then boom.
And so that's infinite mana as long as you have like one other mana rock. In this case, you're going to have 50. And then again, we said as soon as you get infinite mana with Urza, that last ability where you pay five, shuffle your library, exile the top card, and then until end of turn, you may play that card without paying its mana cost, means that you can immediately play your entire deck, which is, you know, basically means if you ever go infinite on mana, you're going to win. Because anytime you can play your entire deck, you're going to, you know, have a couple cards in there that are just going to make you win.
Basalt Monolith and Rings of Bright Hearth are power artifact. Now, this is just another, like, mono-blue staple in terms of, like, being able to untap the Basalt Monolith and generate more mana than it costs to untap it. Gosh, Power Artifacts is a very expensive card, but Rings of Bryhearth, Basalt Monolith, I mean, they're all expensive cards. That's sort of the nature of
what... I mean, Dramatic Reversal and Isochron aren't.
That's true. I mean, the thing about Mono Blue is they just have 1,000 different ways of doing something like this, and they have cards like Palancron in the deck, in the colors that allow you to just do pretty crazy shenanigans in general. Unwinding Clock is a card that we saw Ashlyn use to great effect in Game Nights. Also, again, very good in terms of acting semi like a Prophet of Kruphix slash
Seaborn Muse in this deck, basically. Because imagine you just have like six or seven artifacts out, which won't be hard at all. Then that means you're doing that last ability, shuffle your library, exile the top card, play it without paying its mana cost on everybody's turn.
Mm-hmm.
Just that on a base level is crazy. Blink Moth Infusion. Yeah, bring this one up. This is 12 blue for an instant, but it has affinity for artifacts, so it costs one colorless less to cast, or one generic less to cast for each artifact you control, and then you untap all artifacts.
Right.
So if you have enough artifacts, it wouldn't be that hard to just pay blue and untap all your artifacts.
Well, it's 14, so if you have seven artifacts, you can tap them all for a blue mana, and this costs seven less, so then you immediately just cast this, untap everything, and you're on your way.
So... Aetherflux Reservoir is also a card that would be very, very powerful in this deck because there's a bunch of cards. There's a whole suite of cards that bounce all your artifacts back to your hand.
Yep. And if they're all zero cost or you're already playing them and they can tap for mana, you can just replay all of them and then boom, your life total is... You could storm off with Urza.
I think it'd be pretty easy the turn you play Urza, right? You play Urza, you play like seven or eight Cheerios-style artifacts.
Or they're already on the battlefield from having drawn them earlier.
You play Aetherflux Reservoir. Then you play something like Hercule's Recall on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
There's Rebuild, Retract, Displacement Wave.
Paradoxical Outcome.
You bounce all those artifacts back to your hand. You play them again. Now, there's seven or eight of them, so that's seven or eight Aetherflux Reservoir triggers. If you can bounce them back to your hand one more time, you're now looking at... You've cast
15,
17, 16. 20 spells maybe, counting Urza that turn, counting, you know,
and that's the Aetherflux Reservoir.
Yeah.
So much life.
You're at easily over, 160 life. And
Paradoxical Outcome also just draws you all those cards too.
Paradoxical Outcome returns non-land permanents to your hand and you draw a card for each one of them.
Yeah.
And again, because they're free to cast, you just drop them back down, but that is casting spells.
Yeah. You can play cards like Mycosynth Lattice to make everything an artifact, and then Memnarch. Just steal everyone's thing because you have infinite blue mana.
As soon as you go infinite. Yeah, and this creates infinite colored mana.
Yeah, that's the nutty part about it.
You can steal everything. So, all right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his final line of text, which is okay. Five mana, shuffle your library, then exile the top card, and then you can play that card without paying its mana cost. So in a lot of ways, this is actually better than card draw because you're casting a card for free off the top of your library. Also, it says shuffle your library specifically so you can't use stuff like Scroll Rack to stack the top of your library and then use those cards.
Brainstorm, those things don't work to like set up. But it doesn't matter because you're not going to do this hoping for what the top thing is. You're just going to do it just 50 times, you know? I don't care what the top thing is because I'm going to do this enough where I'm going to find whatever it is that I'm looking for.
You can't cast lands off it, but yeah. You can play it.
Yeah, right. You play it.
You can play a land.
And you don't pay the mana cost, so whatever it is, that thing is happening.
Yeah.
It seems pretty nuts. I think easily competitive level broken if you build it with all the infinite combos.
Yeah.
If you don't, still seems very, very good. It harkens to Thrasios in a lot of ways, too, because that same play pattern of like I create a lot of mana, however much it is, whether it's infinite or not, and that allows me to just rifle through my deck and play a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Because when you make the activation cost, in this case, I guess if it was colored, it wouldn't matter because the artifacts are creating blue mana.
I would have thought that it would be colored. No, they make it generic just because.
What I would have done with this card is the tap and untapped artifact you control, have it add one colorless mana, and then make it cost four and a blue to activate that last part where you shuffle your library and then play the top card.
Right, so you can't
keep a check and balance on it a little bit.
Instead, we have the card that we have in front of us right now. And not to mention, like, Thrasios is great when you get stuff like Training Grounds out and the fact that you can partner with another commander and you have to have a couple other pieces to really get it going and a ton of mana. Urza just skips all of those steps by having the effect on him, and it's absurdly powerful. And you're playing the card, too. You're not just drawing it, like with Thrasios. And the fact that all your artifacts just turn into mana rocks. It's for colored mana. For colored mana. Oh.
Imagine if Thrasios also had a ramp mechanic on him.
Yeah.
That's what Urza is.
Yeah.
They were like, if you have a lot of mana, you could just play cards for free.
Yeah.
Let's make him also help you have a lot of mana. You know, it would feel bad to have him out and you don't have a lot of mana.
Yeah, and it would feel bad if you had him out a lot of mana and couldn't do anything with it. So let's give him an ability that can just get you right back in the game in case you're behind somehow by just playing cards off the top of your library for free.
I suppose we could take this opportunity here because for like a little game design discussion.
Yeah, this is probably the most interesting part of the episode for me too.
So I think, you know, recently, and I'm talking in the last like 6 months maybe, we've seen a few cards that are a little bit scary to me. Vanifar, one of them. Bolas's Citadel, I think, is on that list. And now Urza. Is Wizards making cards that are too powerful now? Have they strayed over the line?
Well, it's funny because in general, everyone sort of believes, not everyone, a lot of players will say that the most powerful cards came from like Urza's Saga, which of course, shares a namesake.
It has Urza in its name. And
that was because at R&D during the time, people were just going nuts. They're like, whatever, let's just make fun stuff. And they ended up making a ton of broken, busted stuff. And since then, we've all seen a marked decrease in terms of the general power level of things because they need to enter into Standard and in general. And then the cards that they print in Commander that are really powerful, like True Name Nemesis, weren't even that amazing for Commander. So they found, a pretty good balance of not making super busted stuff. But even with like Paradox Engine.
Yeah, that's another one, and that was maybe a year before that.
Like I feel like
2 years maybe.
I don't think obviously R&D knows what they're doing and they can see this card and go like, yeah, why not? But I don't think for Modern Horizons they were particularly being like, well, we should make sure that EDH doesn't get busted because of this.
I mean, I can understand it on a card that doesn't have the word legendary creature on it.
True.
But whenever that's there's only 8 or 9 of those per set. You think that they in-house they'd be like, okay, let's look at the legendary creatures real quick, and let's make sure that they're not like absolutely busted, broken for Commander. You know, because you can sort of forgive Bolas's Citadel and Paradox Engine a little bit. They're going to be in the 99, but something like Urza, like you look at it, and your first thought has to be this can be your Commander because it says legendary creature right on it.
Yeah, my second thought is this is probably the most powerful mono blue Commander ever printed.
I don't know. Teferi's pretty good.
Teferi's good, but
Teferi's going to do what this deck's going to do in almost a very similar way. It's going to go infinite.
It comes out
on mana
a little later. It costs more. You can only activate it once a turn unless you use Chain Veil tactics. Like,
well, this, I mean, that's the whole thing, but yeah.
This card has everything on the actual card. And it's not like Teferi where you have to like choose one. Because sometimes people will play Teferi and like, all right, fine, I'll draw cards or discard or whatever, you know.
Well, that's normal Teferi, but yeah, the combo-y Teferi deck. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I have the Teferi deck, the combo-y one, and it's very powerful. This could be more powerful, though. It's definitely possible.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like turning... Because like fast mana is one of the prime staples of CEH decks, and Urza being able to create more fast mana seems very powerful.
It's like, hi, my deck has 20 Moxes in it.
Yeah.
Like, how is that not going to be just crazy broken?
Yeah, do you think this card's going to get banned?
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I think no, based on the fact that, like...
Teferi exists, too.
The only way it would get banned is if it was a step above what's already Tier 1 right now.
Right.
If it's basically equal to the Breakfast Hulk decks and mm-hmm. the Doomsday decks and the Teferi decks and the Najilas and all that... then I think it's fine. Like,
yeah.
But if it starts looking like, oh, this deck is, you know, even better than those, then I think the RC might consider banning in that circumstance. Because in general, what do we see with Vanifar? It wasn't even the most popular or most built commander from that set, which I think says a lot about commander players and is actually great.
Yeah.
They aren't trying to skew towards the most powerful thing all the time. Like, a lot of people recognized, yeah, Vanifar, it's super powerful. It's actually so powerful that I don't actually think it's going to be fun.
Yeah, and it also leads to a very linear playstyle of, like, you have to get these cards in that order for it to win.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people can... And also, like, you're shuffling your library constantly to get those cards. So I can see people not liking that kind of thing. Urza, I can see having a similar effect, because if you are just constantly acting in the five, unless you're doing it infinitely, you do have to shuffle your library every single time.
I mean, I think most groups would be like... just do the top card because it doesn't matter. Card. Like,
unless you brainstormed
or something, right. Like, you know, unless you should know it, then you can shortcut the shuffle thing. Like, yeah. If everybody looks around and goes, you know, I don't know what the top card is, right? Nobody does. So shuffling it won't make any difference. So let's just speed this up. But I think it's an interesting question, and I do think maybe R&D is straying in the wrong direction with power level of cards.
Oh, interesting.
Because I see Bolas's Citadel, Vanifar, and mm-hmm. Urza for sure. As like, wow, we should probably take the dial and turn it down a notch or two.
Well, think about the first commander sets that came out, because we have to know this is the first time Modern Horizons has existed.
Right.
The first commander sets had stuff like Animar and stuff in there, and those are considered very, very powerful. At least for that time, they're very powerful.
Yeah.
So maybe we're seeing a little bit of that effect, which is like new shiny thing. We want to make a splash. We want to make this set, you know, we want people to buy it, obviously, and we want more people to invest in these cards.
But I mean, did they should learn, like... Vanifar doesn't make people buy sets. Feather does.
Right.
You know, Taysa, the new Taysa was much more popular than Vanifar. Don't make the most powerful card. That's actually not what commander players mostly want.
Already in the most powerful color, too, as well in commander, so.
Well, there's some debate about that based on our statistics episode. But, okay.
I know.
All right, so we're going to leave Urza behind now. We're going to let him go. He's going to go play in the competitive pot over there where I don't usually
I don't think you can make a casual deck, really.
I mean, maybe. But speaking of Feather.
Yes. Speaking of Feather, when the card came out, there was such hype around it. It was amazing. On our Discord server, which is available to certain tiers of our Patreon, people decided to start brewing decks around Feather. And so what we did was we had a server-wide, hey, come on into this channel. If you have a deck list or want to talk about cards you might think are cool in Feather, post them here and deliver them to us, and we'll take a look at them. And now that we're, like, I think a couple of months out from that Feather discussion, we have a couple of highlights that we wanted to highlight from our community. And we're going to be doing the same thing for Urza. So if you are a part of our Discord already, you can just hop on over that channel and start brewing away. If you're not, you can join our Patreon. And you might get shouted out on a future episode of the Command Zone podcast.
This is a good look behind the curtain, too, to see how our Discord works for those people that aren't currently patrons.
Yeah.
It is pretty cool and something, you know, we'd like you to consider.
Oh, it's great. You can just be like, hey, family. I like this card. And it'll pop it up and they'll show it in the chat. And other people are like, oh, this works because of this. Like, oh, actually, that interaction doesn't work. And so it's great to get some rules clarification sometimes. Or just be in a like-minded community that we all love and appreciate, of course.
Okay, so what's some of the cool Feather stuff that people came up with?
So Clutch, the Legion's Jank Edge, decided to make a dinosaur-themed Feather deck. Because Enrage, which is awards you essentially for dealing damage to your own creatures. And, of course, Feather has a lot of target spells that are targeting your own stuff. I thought that was pretty cute. Unfortunately, they did not put Rampaging Frost on in, so not
take damage.
That, you know, there's like Ryle and some other stuff.
Yeah.
That actually does seem like it would be great. And there's
there's well, like trap jaw Tyrant and stuff. You're just like, you're going nuts if you can keep.
There's the one that like yeah
back.
Basically like O-rings people too. Yeah, the one that just deals damage. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Sun's Champion decided to make a token slash Heroic Matters deck. Heroic also cares about when you target creatures with your own spells, and they have Mentor of the Meek, Young Pyromancer, and of course Goblin Slide, which if you're casting a non creature spell, you get to pay one and make a goblin.
Probably Monastery Mentor in there too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that sounds a little bit like mine. My version. Yeah.
And Brayden, who was a moderator on Discord as
Brayden
well.
Brayden is our resident competitive player. Yeah.
We had to include one CEDH deck here. There's only six creatures in the deck. It's running Burnout, Red Elemental Blast, every like anti-blue thing in the deck. And has, like we said before, CEDH plays a lot of Cheerios-based ramp. And he has 7 zero-cost ramp artifacts. And he actually made a full primer breaking down the deck as well that you can check out.
Maybe we'll link it in the description. I think he'll give us that link. And then I want to say, too, that Brayden actually said that he took his Feather deck to, like, a GP and played it in some of the competitive pods there, and it did very well, which is surprising. I wouldn't have thought that you could really, even Feather, that you could make it, like, CEDH level, but he said that, like, he's got a pretty control-y version, but that it hangs, so that's
pretty
cool. Impressive.
Yeah. Red, white, hanging in CEDH, that's a first.
It is very impressive.
Yeah, so if you guys want to contribute and join and show us your own brews and discuss it with Josh, myself, and the rest of the community, you can do so on our Discord, join our Patreon, all the details are there.
Okay, so if you're listening to this, you're listening to the audio version, and we are now going to move on to our discussion about War of the Spark draft. So if you're only here for Commander content and you don't draft and you don't play Arena or anything like that, then, you know, feel free to turn it off.
Or skip to the end step where we talk about something cool outside the War of the Magic.
Yeah, that's true. You can listen to the end step. So for those of you that are still around, we're going to talk about War of the Spark draft. We've been doing it a lot on Arena specifically. I haven't drafted... Yep. I've drafted like twice in person and zero on Magic Online. I basically don't open Magic Online anymore.
Yeah, I haven't opened it. I thought about opening it for the Legacy Cube, and I was like, nah, I'd rather just play Draft on whatever.
I just don't want to... I thought about opening it for a Legacy Cube. I did open it. I looked at the, like, you know, like the graphical page or whatever. I was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. Because my brain's just like, oh, no. Go back to Arena.
No.
Yeah.
Also, the feel bads of misclicking in that are so brutal.
It's just so slow, too. Like, you do something, it takes a minute to actually, like,
even the
happen.
Card tapping is like...
You can't, like, drag your cards onto the battlefield. Like,
yeah, that's really annoying, too.
Okay. So, War of the Spark draft. It's a pretty complex format. I know a lot of people are having some troubles with it.
Yeah.
Jimmy, you said you haven't been doing that great.
I haven't been doing that great. I actually...
And you usually do, like, pretty good in draft format.
Yeah,
so.
I always get to, like, platinum level in terms of Arena, and I always find that I post winning records. But for this, I've just found that unless I'm going a very specific direction or forcing it, I've just been losing a lot. And losing a lot in what I think is going to be a lot of people's complaints about War of the Spark in some pretty feel-bad ways.
Yeah, I think the format is pretty tough. I've been doing really good. At some point, I had like an 85% win percentage after
Josh is going pro. You heard it here first.
I mean, I was talking about like 60 or 70 matches. Like it was like deep in. So I'm not saying I have it solved, but I have a pretty good outlook, I think, on the set.
Well, it's very complex. And the main thing is like, what do you attack and when do you attack it? And what are... Threat assessment is huge in this format.
It's the most complicated format that I think I've played, including master sets and stuff, because the Planeswalkers add so many layers of decisions.
True.
So we're going to walk through it a little bit, and maybe we can help everybody out. You know, our Arena episode of the podcast where we were like, how to reach Mythic, we heard from a lot of people that actually got to Mythic and followed our advice, and so hopefully we can help you guys out too. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was Prince or Pauper. So there's been a lot of talk about War of the Spark, and a lot of the chatter out there has been like, it's a very bomb-heavy, bomb-driven format. And it feels very swingy because it feels like luck plays a really big factor. Because if you open
something great,
if you open Oketra, there's just a lot of times it feels like you can't, like, Oketra's unbeatable. Like, if my opponent plays it, I just cannot win.
Yeah, even some Planeswalkers when they land on the battlefield.
Liliana,
there's so many times Ugin. On turn 5 or 6, something happens, and I look at the board, I look at my hand and go, I just lose.
Yeah, I just have no way to get out of this situation. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I thought that at first, but as I played it more, because obviously over the course of that amount of matches, I didn't have bombs most of the time. I just had, like, sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't, just like any other set.
But you played against them a lot, too, then.
Played against them a ton. I've beaten every single bomb. And listen, Oketra, very, very hard to beat. You can beat it, but if they have Oketra in their deck, your percentage chance to win that match has definitely gone down.
It's also very skill testing in terms of how do I beat it now that it's here.
Now, yeah, so, but I actually don't think it's as sort of princely as people are saying. I think the bombs are beatable. You just have to sort of draft knowing what's how the set works, and it's not as intuitive, I think, as it might seem. So the first question we're going to ask here is, how do you beat the bombs? Because that's one of the big complaints people have, is right. I just can't beat those bombs. And the really tough bombs that a lot of people are complaining about are the God Eternals.
Right, and the God Eternals are especially difficult because anytime they die or are put into exile from the battlefield, so you can't even like Wanderer Strike to get them out of the way, they get tucked back into your library third from the top. So they're going to draw them again, and you're going to have to play against it again. So getting rid of them is hard. You can't just traditionally remove them because they'll come back. You can't even exile them because they're going to get back to you as well.
Yeah, not my favorite mechanic. I would have preferred that they
the exile clause this. Is yeah, like the real, oh, what?
That's just like a little bit mean. It makes it pretty quite a bit tougher than it would normally be. So there's some ways to deal with it, and I actually value some of these cards a little bit higher because of their ability to deal with God Eternals. And so when I'm drafting, I'm thinking like, if I run into a God Eternal, I want to have at least, I don't want to just be dead to it. I want my deck to have a chance against these cards. So one of them is Kazmina's Transmutation. I think most people know about this one. It's an enchantment that turns a creature into a 1/1 with no abilities.
Right. So removes flying, removes all the other things. And even if that creature now dies, it's not like Kazmina's Transmutation flies off. It just dies. It dies as a card.
When it dies, it has no ability. So it doesn't have that ability of tuck it back into your graveyard.
Right.
Or sorry, into your library. So if you put that on Oketra and then Oketra somehow dies, then it's not coming back.
Yeah.
Or if the Oketra doesn't die, it's just a 1/1 for the rest of the game, so it still works in your favor.
Yeah, it becomes like a chump blocker later on. The nice thing about Kazmina's Transmutation is this is Blue's form of removal. It can't directly get rid of something, but it can change it to something else. The problem with Kazmina's Transmutation is that sometimes creatures have 5+1/+1 counters on it, so you turn it into a 1/1 that's a 6/6.
Yeah, I think Kazmina's Transmutation is good against Guard Eternals. In general, I don't like having it in my deck because it's not very good against the rest of the format.
Yeah.
Also, just having a chump blocker laying around is valuable because of Planeswalkers. So there's a lot of times we're like, I wish I would have just killed that creature because I want to attack through it. But they're just going to chump block with the Kazmina's Transmutation creature. Yep. And now they'll get an extra activation on their Planeswalker. So again, that is a card I would side in if you're playing in the best of threes.
And in some decks, you do want, if you have a ton of flyers, for example, in your deck, this is a perfectly good card to put in. As well as sometimes, you know, people have like a Crunch Wrangler that just gets bigger and bigger, or a Spellkeeper Gorge. Spell Gorge or Weird. Yeah, that thing just grows and grows and grows. So if you can land it early, then it's great. Otherwise, sometimes the card just looks real useless in your hand.
Yeah, I don't prioritize it highly. And in best of ones, I don't really like to play it. I found Totally Lost to be actually pretty good against God Eternals if you have a couple ways to mill. So the blue Bond of Insight
is
a really good card. It mills both players for 4, and then you get to return either 2 instants, 2 sorceries, or an instant and sorcery from your graveyard to your hand. So it gives you 2 cards back. But I think the fact that it mills your opponent gives you some outs against God Eternals. So a lot of times you can, on the end step, totally lost their God Eternal to the top of their library. Then on your turn, Bond of Insight, and it mills.
Or even just kill the God Eternal.
If you kill the god and then mill him for 4, it's going to put it in the graveyard too. That's a good point.
Yeah, there are also cards like Ashiok out there that mill players. Now, in general, I've actually built a couple of decks that successfully mill people out.
Yeah.
Which is a very fun way to play in this format.
If I were guessing, I've killed people the most and died the most. If there was one card, it's Ashiok.
It's Ashiok, yeah.
Yeah, I've won the most games with Ashiok and have lost the most games to Ashiok. That card is real. It is super scary. There's a bunch of ways to get it back and blink it, or you can get 2 or 3 of them, in which case it's sort of unbeatable sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you get 5 full activations off it, that's 20
cards in a 40-card deck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Toll of the Invasion.
Card's so good.
Hand Disruption usually isn't that amazing, especially when it costs 3 mana. This is 2 in a black for a sorcery. You look at your opponent's hand, you exile a non-land permanent from it, or a non-land card from it.
Yeah, they just discard it, but
they discard it, and then you create a 1-1. You amass 1, sorry.
Yeah, you basically Thoughtseize them and amass 1.
Yeah, but boy, oh boy, if there is ever a format to look at your opponent's hand and pick something out of it, it's this one. Because not just God Eternals, but sometimes you'll see other cards in there that you just look at and go, can't beat it.
Liliana, Ugin, some other Planeswalker, Sarkhan, or something crazy like that. All the God Eternals. Toll of the Invasion, I will run 3 or 4 of them in my deck if
really?
I can. It also amasses 1, which is a really big deal. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Well, right, because you're taking turn 3 off to cast this card, and you don't want to take a ton of damage back if they're ramping out, or if they're just curving out normally.
Yeah, I've had games where I'm like, turn 3, toll you, turn 4, toll you, turn 5, toll you, and they're just like, done.
Yeah.
And you just took their 3 best cards.
And they're left with like 2/2s.
Yeah, and you're like, the cards that you still have remaining, I'm not scared of.
Yeah.
So Toll is very high pick. I think it's probably the 4th best black common, which is saying a lot because black is really
cruelty, good. Cruelty, Spark Harvest,
Lazotep Reaver.
Lazotep Reaver.
Yeah, cool. We'll talk about that in a minute too. And just discard. So Davriel is discard, and then
Davriel's
Shadowfuge.
Yeah.
Shadowfuge. So these are not, well, Davriel's good, but Davriel's Shadowfuge, not generally a great card. But if I know my opponents have a couple bombs in their deck, I'm way more likely to side one in. Again, this is in the best of threes.
Mm-hmm.
In best of ones, I might run one, but I really wouldn't like to. I want to rely on one of these other ways.
It's not great card advantage,
yeah.
Especially if you draw it late.
So those are sort of ways to beat bombs, and I think you want to have a few different ways. Chances, just like the ability to like, listen, I'm still not favored if they have an Oketcher in their deck maybe, but I have a chance against it. I'm not just dead to it.
Yeah. The last point, too,
and I think people sort of play incorrectly against the God Eternal specifically, which is like they just don't want to kill it. I've had a God Eternal on the table, and they Obnixilus's Cruelty some other creature I've got. Because they don't, I'm going to tuck it into my library and draw it again in three turns.
Right. So they're like, I'm just not going to kill it. I'll just deal with it for now.
Here's the problem. Killing it still is card parity. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're down a card and they're up a card, but they're not. It's like totally lost. It puts it back in their library. You're going to have to deal with it again. But imagine it as if they had a second copy of that same card.
Right.
You still killed the first copy. They still have to draw it. It still takes their draw step. It also gives you a couple of turns in the clear. And that's the way I beat, actually, most of the time, the God Eternals, is kill it, try and win the game before it comes back out. Or that turn they get it and cast it.
No escape.
Yeah.
Counter it. Or, you know, I've actually...
Yeah, no escape's a really good one, yeah.
I've had a couple of God Eternal Bantu. It has Menace. I knew I was already at a high life total, but I think the big thing you have to ask yourself is, race it. You can race a lot of these cards, too, if you have the right kind of board state. And if your opponent doesn't realize that your out is to kill them before they can kill you, then...
Ronus, once it's out, it's just a 5-5. Like, it's not the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
Oketra and Kefnet are the two you have to kill because they will accrue more advantage from that point.
Yeah.
But I think people are not killing them when they can. And listen, if you look across the battlefield and you've got a kill spell and that's the best creature on your opponent's board, and if they've got one, it is.
And if you can kill them and then crack in for like 6-7 damage and put them down super low, it gives you, because at a certain point too, I've had a lot of Guard Generals just have to sit there and block.
Yeah. Sometimes you just go, listen, here's what I need to happen. I kill this and they draw land, and then I can win.
Yeah.
But that's an out. If your other
out is just, I'm not going to touch it and just hope it somehow works out. Yeah, what are you hoping for? That you're going to top deck something? It's like, no, you need to look at the damage you can put out and try and race them if you have to. And that's there are tempo swings that are huge because there's a great episode of Limited Resources called Who's the Beatdown?
Yeah.
And I think, which is basically like, are you the aggressor or are you being aggressed on? So play around that. And I think a lot of times people, as soon as they see a God Eternal, switch it. And like, oh, all of a sudden I can't attack anymore. And a lot of times that's actually not the case.
Now you have to be the beatdown. It's Oketra because I can't win a long game now.
Yeah.
I only can win a short game. So I need to, there's been plenty of times where they play something like Oketra and I'm like, yep, I'm going to chump attack in.
Yeah,
now.
I'm going to lose my best creature.
Because my only hope is like they don't draw a creature in the next three turns or two turns or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Planeswalkers sort of present a different problem. So like the Lilianas and the Ugins of the bombs, the Sarkins, they're really bomby planeswalkers. This is something about the format that I think is very, very important. And we'll get into this a little bit earlier, but I want some ways to get at planeswalkers because there's a bunch of ones, not just the super bombs, but there's the Kaias and the, you know,
Kasminas
and the Vraskas,
Arlens.
Even Chandra is a real pain.
Oh my gosh, Chandra's the biggest pain in the butt.
Yeah, so I want some sort of maybe one or two sneaky ways to get at a Planeswalker if I have to. And some of these also work against the God Eternal. So like Stealth Mission.
This card's gone up and up.
Yeah.
Someone played three of them against me and I just got wiped off the face of the planet.
It's 2 and a blue for a sorcery. You put 2+1/+1 counters on a creature and it can't be blocked for that turn.
Normally this card is just not a very playable card because it's a one-time use. You're getting some damage him, but for what purpose?
It's kind of like an enchantment aura that you wouldn't normally play, but in this set, because you need to get out of Planeswalker out of nowhere, because a lot of times they're looking at the board and they're like, I got three blockers, they got two attackers, it's safe for me to play my Planeswalker, I'm gonna plus it if it's Liliana, make a zombie and say go, and what are they gonna do? And if you have Stealth Mission, a lot of times you can be like, I Stealth Mission my guy, swing in, kill Liliana, and now it's not that bad. They played a 6-mana zombie. And it took a card out of your hand, the Stealth Mission, but in general, that trade is not game losing. You can win that game now. Whereas if Lilian just sits there making 2/2s over and over and then eventually ultimates or makes everybody sacrifice creatures, they draw cards, like the longer that goes on, you just can't win.
Yeah.
Also, God Eternals. So that's like what we're saying. God Eternal comes down. Sometimes you go, okay, well, stealth mission, swing in for 7 or 8, puts you to like 4 or 5.
And now they have to play another creature. Otherwise, you're just going to be able to out-attack them. Or you have, let's say, a Pegasus Courser guy, yeah, whatever that is, or some way of just a little bit of evasion. Evasion in general is really great against Planeswalkers. The ways that I've killed Planeswalkers the most, if I'm in red, it's a burn spell. If I'm in any other color, it's a flyer.
Yeah, flyers are really, really good because of that. So, you know, all the white flyers, the blue's got a bunch of flyers, obviously.
Shriek Diver
is a playable card because of that. Ashiok Skulker I've actually found to be very, very good because it's a good blocker for your Planeswalkers.
3/5.
And a lot of times they won't play their Vraskas and stuff into it because they're like, okay, so I play this, I activate, I get a 1/1 Death Toucher, and then they just pay 4 mana and kill my Vraska.
Mm-hmm.
And still have their Skulker, so it didn't even cost them a card. So do I want to play a 4 mana 1/1 Death Touch? No.
No.
So then you're causing them to hold cards in their hand. You don't even know that the Skulker's the reason you're winning those games, but mm-hmm. it is because they're sitting there waiting to answer the Skulker before they play their Planeswalker, which can really jam them up.
Yeah. In fact, it may be better for them to do that and have you waste your mana to attack into that, because then they're like, all right, next turn I'm going to develop out something even bigger or better.
So the bombs I actually have the hardest time with, and I think are worse than the God Eternals, worse than the Lilianas and Ugins of the world, are Time Wipe,
ugh,
Finale of Glory, and Finale of Eternity.
So that's the white and black finales.
The white and black finales and the blue and white board wipe. These, to me, are the hardest cards to deal with in the format.
Well, Time Wipe is particularly hard because you're able to save a creature when you do it, and blue also, one of the commons is Spellgorger Weird, which allows you to sacrifice it and bring back a sorcery and instant from your graveyard to your hand.
So they can kind of do it a lot.
Do it a lot, right.
So it destroys all creatures, but before you do that, you bounce one of your creatures back to your hand.
Yeah. And a lot of times I've just played it onto an empty board because I had nothing. Just having a board wipe in this format is extremely powerful. And
Solar Blaze is also good, but not as good as Time Wipe.
Not even close.
Because it doesn't kill Ashiok Skulkers and stuff.
Yeah.
Finale to Glory, or Finale of Glory, is that white and X spell where you make X 2/2s, or if it's 10 or more, you make 2/2s and 4/4 flyers.
Yeah.
I mean,
sometimes you only need to make 5 2/2s.
Oh, often. I'd say if you...
4 to 5 and you will win the game.
If X is equal to 5, you're winning almost every time.
Yeah, because at that point, you're happy to just swing all in every single turn, and they can't really block everything.
Yeah.
Against board stalls is pretty good, too. Gives you a much bigger army. If you're ahead, oh, boy.
Then you can just wait, too, sometimes. I've had it. I've cast it for 10, and I've had it cast for 10 against me. Like,
oh, yeah, just
games
wait.
Go long.
Yeah.
I've naturally decked in games because there's a lot of board stalls, so you can just sit there, wait, nothing scary, cast it for 10, just win. The black finale is the one where you destroy up to 3 creatures with toughness
X
or less.
Yeah.
Again, with Spellgorger, or no, sorry, the blue weird, the spell something weird.
I think blue spell... one. Something weird.
You sacrifice it for 2 mana and then get an instant or sorcery out of your graveyard. With that card in Finale,
it is Spellgorger
of Eternity.
Weird. No, it's not. Spellgorger
is the black. The red one.
Yeah, the red one.
Anyway, so you can get Finale of Eternity back a couple of times. That's like nearly unbeatable.
Spellkeeper weird.
Spellkeeper.
Not Gorger.
Keeper.
Gorger is red. Keeper is blue. Duh.
Here's one thing I would say, too, on Arena, and if you're trying to get Mythic, you have to play Best of One, and that Best of One definitely makes dealing with the bombs harder.
So much harder.
If you're playing for value and you want to just keep playing and you want to be able to draft a lot and win enough so that it's not costing a bunch of gems, too, then Best of Three is actually going to help you out a lot because you can see the God Eternals in Game 1 and then side in those Kazmina Transmutations. You can side in a Stealth Mission.
Mm-hmm.
You can side in, you know, a discard spell or two. You can do some stuff, whereas in Best of One, you kind of have to pre-sideboard a little.
Yeah.
And you can do the thing I'm talking about in Best of One, too, which is as you get up towards about 4 or 5 wins, you're very likely to run into the Liliana decks and the Oketra decks and the things like that, because they have those cards they got to 4 or 5 wins.
Side in your Toll of the Invasions, discards, and all that stuff.
I'm way more likely to bring Kazmina's Transmutation in once I get like 4-1, 4-0.
Yeah, that's a good point. You can edit your deck between rounds, which is something that you're not allowed to do in MTGO when you draft.
Right.
So that's something that I would definitely keep an eye out. You can always change up your deck. If you find that a card just isn't working for you, go in and edit it before you play your next round.
Okay, so let's talk about what I consider to be the key to the format and the biggest thing. And if you are out there and having trouble drafting War of the Spark, I think if you pay attention to this next piece of advice, it will up your win percentage by a decent amount. It's you need to pick and play the low drops, that's specifically 2 drops, really,
mm-hmm.
higher than you are. So this format is about dictating the battlefield conditions because of Planeswalker. It's about getting out there early and making sure that you are on the board and dictating to the Planeswalkers. And by dictating, I mean saying to your opponent, if you play Planeswalker now, you can't get full value out of it.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bad position to play a Planeswalker. Or saying, you can't get to my Planeswalker. So the really good two drops are in red, there's Burning Prophet. Yep. In black, there's Lazotep Reaver. In green, there's Pollenbright Druid. In blue, there's Sky Theater Strix. That one surprised me. I thought that was going to be crap, but
I like that card a lot.
It's definitely good. White has the War Screecher, which is not great, and the other two on the ground. I don't like white very much in this format. We'll get to that in a minute. There's also uncommon Tybalt Rager, Dread Malkin, and Eternal Taskmaster, which I considered to be very good. I want 5 or 6 2-drops in my deck, and I will go into the vanilla 2/2s or even a Prismite or something if I have to make sure I have at least 5 or 6 2-drops. I feel like missing a 2-drop is a really good way to lose the game.
Yeah, because if you're on the play and you miss it, it feels bad. If you're on the draw and you miss it, then you're already super behind.
Also, if they go 3-drop, 4-drop Planeswalker, and you didn't play a 2 and a 3, you can't get to it, and you're just done.
Yeah. Dreadmalkin's also very good because cards that have Menace also are very relevant.
It's basically like a Haz Evasion.
Yeah, and it has the ability to pump itself up really quickly in case, you know, there are a lot of tokens flying around, a lot of fodder as well for cards like Dreadmalkin.
I think it's hard to tell that that's the reason you win games when you play these early drops, because what happens, like we talked about earlier, you play a 2-drop, it goes to your opponent, and they're holding like a Planeswalker or 2 in their hand, and they're thinking like, okay, I can't put it down. I have to play a creature so that it can block for my Planeswalker, and then they do that, and then you play another creature, and they're like, okay. If I play my Planeswalker now, they got free attacks on it.
I'll play another creature, or I'll just pass the turn, even better.
So I can't play it, so maybe I do nothing, or I do not the best play. I don't play the best card out of my hand. And you tempo them to the point where, like, by the time they do play it, if they ever can really get a good spot, it's too late to have the impact that they wanted it to. Think of, like, here's a sequence that I've had happen a lot, because I draft Lazotep Reaver, like, super high.
Yeah, card's very good in this format.
I think it's probably, like, my favorite card in black. I'll take the removal spell over it. I think if I have an Obnixilis's Cruelty and a Spark Harvest, I'll probably take Lazotep Reavers over them from then out in the draft.
If you already have one in your deck.
If I have one of each of those, then I'll take my second, third, fourth Lazotep Reaver before I'll take a second, third, or fourth Obnixilis's Cruelty or something.
Yeah, I mean, you're creating two bodies for one card, and in a game when you're trying to have more creatures than your opponent so that you can freely attack in and stop them from playing Planeswalkers, that's what makes a big difference.
The amass token is actually really important, because if you can amass again, it's like creating something with haste that's bigger.
Yeah.
Because you already have the 1/1 out there. Amass works totally better than I thought it would. We'll talk about that in a second. But this play pattern I've had happen a lot. Turn 2, Lazotep Breather. Turn 3, Davriel. You just win.
Yeah, you discard pretty much every card in their hand past that point.
It's like they mold to 5.
Yeah.
You can even chump block with your Lazotep Reaver. A lot of times they can't get to you because they didn't play a 2-drop. But even if they have a creature, they go, okay, 3-drop, and you're like, chump block, take your second card.
Yeah.
Attack you again, chump block, take your third card.
And you're probably going to have played something else at that point, too.
They're done.
Yeah.
They're totally done at that point. Never mind if you go, like, Aid the Fallen, get Davriel back.
Well, Aid the Fallen is also just, I think, one of the better black commons in the set, because you can rebuy cards like Davriel and Ashiok, and those are cards that are win conditions in and of themselves.
So play more 2-drops. Take the 2-drops highly. Burning Prophet should go very highly. It's like the second or third best red common. Jai's Greeting, I think, is better, but Burning Prophet is, you know, at a certain point, there are times where I've got 3 Jaya's Greetings. I'm taking a Burning Prophet over that.
Well, here's the thing about Burning Prophet, too, is that if games are going long, the scry value, as well as the fact that you can sometimes crack in for a lot more damage, is really, really important. Because you need to make sure, like, the ways that I've lost games are you're super far ahead, and the opponent starts to catch up, and then you hit, like, a rut of lands.
Yep.
So any way to make sure that you're more consistent in your draws, especially to, it's like, you started the race really strong, but you have to carry it to the end in this format.
Sky Theater Strix, 1/2 flyer, gets +1/+0 if you cast a non-creature spell, is way better than it looks, because the way they designed basically the non-rare Planeswalkers is they activate twice, and then they're at 1 loyalty.
Yep.
So their static ability will still be there. So if you can ever hit one of them for 2, you take away an activation. And most of them are not great if they only get to activate once. You're paying 4 mana for a 1/1 Death Toucher. You're paying 4 mana for a 2/2 that loots. You're paying, you know...
Well, that's why cards like Arlen are so good.
You're playing
good,
3 mana for a 1/1 that deals 1 damage. Like,
yeah. And most of the planeswalkers get two activations before they're about to die from the activation, or they cannot even activate because they're at a total that doesn't let them do it again.
Yeah, so the Sky Theater Strix very often is like, they won't play their planeswalker because they're like, I only get one activation. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's the key. That's the number one key to the format. Let's talk about colors and how the colors work.
Blue and black are definitely the best. That I've just come to see.
I don't know. Red is up there. I think black...
Because of the removal?
I think black is the best color.
Yeah.
I think... Because we just talked about how many black cards. And the top four black cards are all awesome.
Yeah. And the commons are all awesome, too. Yeah. And their bombs are pretty darn good.
I mean, I think the real thing takeaway is avoid white. White is pretty bad. I'm not saying you can never play it, but I have to open a time wipe or a finale of glory.
And even then, you might splash the time wipe. Yeah. Well, you can't really splash time wipe. Yeah. Well, I think the thing about
green, you can because of New Horizons.
Yeah, the thing I've found that a lot of players have, I've been like streaming this as well, and people have been like, "White's so good, it's got so much removal." And I think that's one of the easy traps to fall into in limited, which is like just because you have ways to get rid of stuff doesn't make the color as a whole good, because R&D will try and balance all the colors out to have equal types of removal in terms of power level. And if you think about it, the other colors do have good removal. It's just that white is more transparent on the surface with how they like to do it.
Yeah, white is just played out very poorly every time I've had it. I don't like it. Again, if I get one of the white super bombs,
yeah,
I will play white. But otherwise, you know, like a normal white rare or like Teferi or something will come in and I'll be like, nope, Omnix is Nyxilis's cruelty. Because I just don't want to be near white if I can.
Yeah. Well, Teferi's also just not that good, but...
Yeah, it's like an okay card. So... The Grixis colors are the colors I really want to be in. So I want to be blue-black, blue-red, or red-black. I think all three of those decks are awesome. I'm actually not even sure which of those three is the best. I used to think it was blue-red spells. Mm-hmm. And then I went on this huge run where I just, you know, I went like 20-2 with like red-black. Just
oh, nice.
Just four times in a row. You know, I was like, well, red-black's the best deck, but... Blue black is also like super good, and I rarely lose with it. So,
yeah,
anything in Grixis is good. I almost always start out black if I can. I think it's just the deepest color, and I think blue is the second best color.
Yeah, and green has been a little disappointing to me too, even though it's got some of the better enders. Even just that 6 mana 7/6.
Yeah,
you know, which is like some of those cards are like, okay, cool, it's hard to beat. Or if you have a Crunch Wrangler deck in green red that just gets real big, real fast. Raging Crunch, one of my new favorite cards ever.
Favorite name of card.
It's a 3 mana 4/3 that can't attack alone, but it is one of the best blockers. And when it does get to attack, it just hammers home the point that you're killing them through damage.
Yeah, that's the thing I miss about that card actually, was that it could block the first time. You'd think that it's, yeah. I find when I'm green, and I don't know if it's the same for you, I'm usually like green, black, and then I'm usually just green as like a color that's allowing me to play a few blue cards, a few red cards, and maybe a white card.
Right, because you have Centaur Nurturer, you have the Druid, Heritage Druid, I think.
Paradise Druid,
yeah.
Yeah, New Horizons
right.
With Mana Geodes and that the Globe, which is actually turned out to be like the best fixer, I think, in the format. The Globe is, because it replaces
it's
itself.
It's a cantrip, yeah.
So it doesn't flood you out. But that's a lot of times when I'm green, I'm only green because it allows me to play like these, you know, pivot around to grab these planeswalkers and play off color.
Yeah.
Yeah. So avoid white.
Sorry, white. Maybe next time.
So I think one of the other thing is there's some really hard to evaluate cards in this format. So Bolas's Citadel. Listen, great in EDH. We know that. When we drafted in person, you were like, is this card good? And I'm like, yeah. But I only knew that because I'd had it.
Yeah.
Bolas's Citadel is an insane card.
Yep.
Sometimes you just play like cast Bolas's Citadel. Play 5 cards in that turn. Because you're just like, oh, look, Lazar Tip Reaver, yep, play that. Oh, Obnixil's Cruelty, play that. Kill that. Oh, I'll play that. The Tithe
Breaker Giant.
Boom.
Yeah.
And so they won't beat you now.
Yeah, that's the thing is that it pushes you so far ahead that I've had so many games where I've won at 1 or 2 life just because they can't get past my board state.
Because you're like, I have 27 things because I could just play 12 mana worth of stuff on one turn.
Not to mention, Bolas's Hill just also lets you play lands off the top. Yep. So it's similar to Experimental Frenzy in that way. Now, the only thing about it is that it's 3 black.
Yeah.
So you need to have a heavily black deck to be able to play it on curve. But even then, late game, if you're just at a board stall or whatever, that thing will just break it wide open.
Again, New Horizons. I've splashed for it before with like 3 New Horizons because it's that good.
You're crazy.
So here's what I was wrong about, because in that same draft, you asked me, is this card good? And I said no.
Oh, Vivian's Arcbow?
I've
lost that card a lot.
Now I'm like, never mind, I was wrong. Listen, you reevaluate and draft all the time. And
yeah.
Vivian's Arcbow seems like card disadvantage or because you could miss.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the card is just really good.
Yeah, the games that really destroy me are when that's the only thing they have on the battlefield, and I'm like, well, I hope I top deck better than them looking through the top 7 or 8 cards of their library every time.
And also, I can't attack them because they can activate it at instant speed. So they get to go, okay, sit there. Every turn, you know, once they're at 7 mana, every turn they just draw their card and pass the turn to you, and you're like, what do I do? Because if I attack them, they activate the Arc Bow, put who God knows what into play, eat one of my creatures, and now I have a huge thing, possibly. And if I don't attack them, they do that anyway, get the best creature out of their top 7, and just slowly, because I'm going to draw lands eventually.
Yeah.
They're going to draw a creature every turn now.
Yep. Yeah. Pretty much every turn, especially when you're at 7 to 8 mana. And even if the creature isn't that great, if you're discarding a land to do that, that's better than nothing. So,
dude, I had it in a draft with Ilharg.
Oh, nice.
So I would get it, attack. They would like try and block and kill it. It would go third from the top. I would get it back out with the Arc Bow again.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Pretty bad.
That is pretty awful.
One thing I wanted to touch on here, and we're almost done, is so in draft, it's really easy to talk about when you're drafting, how you evaluate cards, what to pick, how to build the best deck.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult to talk about, just like EDH, in-game decisions, but War of the Spark has more in-game decisions that matter in Limited than any other format I've ever played.
Yeah, it's just you're constantly asking yourself, do I do X, Y, or Z? And you have a bunch of different options available, and it's hard to figure out, okay, what is the most optimal thing, and how am I going to win this game?
And I don't know about you, I've made the most mistakes in this format of any format I've ever made. I mean, I don't know how many times I've tried to draw cards when Narset's out, or tried to, like, fireball something when the Wanderer's out. Or like,
Nahiri kills me with first strike damage.
Yeah, exactly. You're just like, you have to keep tabs on all the static effects all the time. Mm-hmm. And I've made, even like Narset's gotten me 4 times maybe. It's not even like I learned the first time it happened. Like, Contentious Plan. Oh, crap.
Oh,
I'm the stupidest person ever. Just the other day, I did Kazmina with Narset out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just like, don't draw the card, now discard a card.
Now discard, yeah, because you can't draw more than one card a turn. Yeah. Wow.
Stupid, but it is very hard. So one thing I want to talk about is blocking and trading, because I think that the dynamic of attacking, blocking, when to trade, when to offer trades is very different in the set because of the Planeswalkers. So in general, you need to alter your decisions when you're attacking and blocking, when you're accepting trades, because of Planeswalkers. So, if you have Planeswalkers of your own, I would say the heuristic you want to use is don't block and offer trades unless you're protecting a Planeswalker.
Mm-hmm.
So, there'll often be times where, like, let's say it's turn 2, and they attack into your 2-2 with their 2-2. In general,
you block.
I'm often being like, if you got a trick, more power to you, I'm going to block, because I'll get that trick out of your hand right now.
And I'd rather, have it now than later when it might
and
be more
And maybe it'll waste your whole turn or whatever. But if I have got Planeswalkers in my deck, I don't want to be facing a creature and I don't have anything on the board.
Right.
So I'm way more likely, in fact, almost always in this set, I'm like, take the damage. I'd rather have the creature on the board. Yeah. I need the creature on the board. Also, if they do that and then play a Planeswalker and you have no board,
how are you going to attack back?
My stealth missions and stuff just don't work anymore. My little tricky ways to get in there just don't work. I need creatures out to protect my Planeswalkers and to attack theirs. So don't be blocking and trading.
For no reason.
Unless you're protecting a Planeswalker. It's not worth it to protect your life total early in the game. And the next thing is, you don't want to attack them and offer trades in the same sense if you know you've got Planeswalkers and stuff in your deck. So there's a lot less attacking on my part in general, just being like, if I attack and they trade here, what happens? What if I draw? Like, a lot of times, what if I draw one of my Planeswalkers? It's just not worth it for the 2 damage. I'm just going to keep this back here so that it can play as a blocker. Because if I play my Kaya and they can't get to it, I'll just win this game.
Yep.
So,
yeah, the Planeswalkers have so much power and they swing the game so heavily in your favor sometimes that you want to protect them at all costs. Because I would say, like, Arlan Cord is probably the only Planeswalker that can take a hit and still get a lot of value out of her.
Everybody else takes 2, and that takes away an entire activation.
Yeah, exactly. So you want to be able to hold that, especially if you're playing like a mill Ashiok deck, then I just try and flood the board. And
you don't care about doing damage because it does nothing for you. You're going to mill them out. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a big, big thing. I very, very often will just take damage when I could trade now because I am really, really wanting to protect my Planeswalkers or be able to get at theirs, and I can't do that if I don't have creatures on the board. So I just don't want... I'm just trying to lessen the amount of chances they have to get my creatures off the board. Okay, I wanted to talk about some tricky stuff. There's cool stuff you can do in the format. You know, us EDH players, we love tricky stuff. The first one is Command the Dreadhorde.
What's your thought on this? Do you think it's a powerful card? I think it's really good.
We misevaluated it in the set review because when we did the set review, we just missed the word damage.
Yeah.
So it's 4BB for a sorcery, and you can
choose any number of creatures
from any graveyards.
And planeswalkers.
And put them onto the battlefield, and then you take damage equal to the converted mana cost of those creatures. Take damage.
Yeah.
We thought it was loss of life. Damage can be prevented or redirected. Mm-hmm. In fact, within this set, there are two different ways to do it. The Wanderer prevents from taking non-combat damage. That's non-combat damage. So if you play Command the Dreadhorde and you have the Wanderer already out on the battlefield, you can't bring the Wanderer out. Yeah, because the damage happens before the creatures get out.
It's
there,
on resolution of the spell, not entering the battlefield effects.
But you can basically get, you can, what's the spell? Rise of the Dark Realms?
Yeah.
If you have Wander out and take zero damage. Gideon's Sacrifice is another one where you can redirect that damage to a creature. Now, again, you have to have the creature out before you cast Command the Dreadhorde.
And you're playing Gideon's Sacrifice, which is not great.
But if I had Command the Dreadhorde, I would play it.
Yeah, totally.
Because that is so powerful to be able to just get like 20 or 30 power worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for 6 mana, like, it's insanity.
Yeah, pretty good.
And there's a lot of blocking and trading once Planeswalkers come out and a lot of things dying. Another one, this is a really cool one. I realized this mid-game in one game. So Chandra, your opponent has a Chandra.
Whenever loyalty counters are removed from Chandra, it deals damage to target player.
To a target opponent or Planeswalker.
Planeswalker, based on the number of counters that are removed.
Right. It's not a Mei ability.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can smack Chandra, that trigger goes on the stack. Let's say she's got three counters. Let's say she's got five counters, you hit her for three.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to do 3 damage to target opponent or Planeswalker. If in response to that trigger you Lazotep Plating, you give yourself Hexproof, they will have to point that damage at Chandra.
Oh, herself, because there's no other Planeswalkers
out. And they can't point it at themselves because it says target opponent.
Very nice.
And so that's a way to kill Chandra's, if Chandra's the only Planeswalker out, otherwise they can point it at
herself.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's actually really cute.
Yeah.
Do you think Lazotep Plating is good? Because that card's gone up and up in my book too.
I think all the Abbas cards are good.
Yeah.
Sorry. What's the 3 and a blue makes Amass 3?
Oh, it's something. It's not Tammy's Epiphany. It's
Relentless Assault.
Yeah.
That one's not good. The ones that it's like, I do something and I amass.
Yeah.
If it's tacked on Amass, it's all good.
Amass is very good.
And the last one is 2 cards we talked about. Spellkeeper Weird. That's the one you pay 2, tap it and sacrifice, get an instant or sorcery out of your graveyard into your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And Aid the Fallen.
Which return up to 1 target creature and 1 target planeswalker from your graveyard to your hand.
So if you have Spellkeeper Weird and a Planeswalker, you can just always get both back.
Right.
The Spellkeeper Weird gets the Aid the Fallen. The Aid the Fallen gets your Planeswalker and the Spellkeeper Weird. Get the Planeswalker out, use it, get it to the graveyard, do it again, rinse, repeat. You can sort of recast the same Planeswalker over and over.
And in long games, it's very, very good. Not to mention, I would say like cards like, is it Spark Reaper? The guy that
Spark Reaver.
Yeah, any of the cards that allow you to sacrifice a Planeswalker as well is really powerful. Like that one allows you to pay 3, sacrifice a creature or Planeswalker, gain a life, draw a card. A lot of times
that
you
card
have,
I found to be awesome, actually.
Yeah, a lot of times you'll have a Planeswalker at 1 loyalty because you've used it twice, and your opponent literally knows, okay, I don't need to attack this thing because if they have Aid the Fallen or whatever, you can sacrifice them, get them back with Aid the Fallen. So those cards
draw
go
a card
up.
And gain a life. Yeah,
yeah, pretty good.
Heartfire, I think, is actually another good card because of that reason. I thought Heartfire was going to be clunky, but you just often have stuff lying around that you can sacrifice.
Including Amass tokens.
All right. That's going to do it on our discussion of Magic the Gathering Arena and War of the Spark Draft. Thanks for sticking around, those people that enjoy that stuff. We've been playing a lot of Arena and really loving it, so we're probably going to talk about it a little more here and there.
Yeah, and we'll probably delve more into also how the bots work, because that's a huge part of learning how to play better draft, is figuring out what they're valuing and what they're not evaluating correctly. For instance, Ugin's Conjuring, one of the best cards in the set. Bots don't think so, though.
Yeah,
unless they've changed their mind recently.
Best uncommon? I mean, it's very high on my list.
It's super high. Well, it goes in every deck. That's why it just shoots up the ladder in terms of how good it is.
Yeah, I'd probably pick Kaya and Kesmin and all that. I would say Kaya's the non-Planeswalker uncommon.
Yeah. Kaya's probably the best uncommon Planeswalker.
Vraska, Kesmina.
Vraska's up there, too. I think Kesmina and Kaya are two different houses of why they're good, but I think Kaya just by herself is nutty. It's one of the best cards in the set.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right. To the listeners, what do you think about Urza? We're going to go back to that. do you think that WotC's been creating cards that are, you know, a little too powerful for the format? What do you think about that part of the discussion? Or what do you think about War of the Spark Draft? Do you have any tips for us or for anybody else out there? You can answer any of those questions, all three, You can cherry pick. Do whatever you want.
Comment below. Tweet at us. Email us. Join our Patreon and our Discord. Join in on the discussion as well about Urza.
And if you want to buy a bunch of zero or very cheap costed artifacts for your Urza deck.
By the way, a lot of them cost very little.
Yeah. Like, and actually, this is one of the great things about Card Kingdom, because some other websites you go to, it's difficult to order like one 25 cent card.
Right. Oh, yeah. You have to pay $1 or $2.
Maybe. Yeah. Card Kingdom, you just make a big cart with a bunch of this stuff in it, and they have all of it. And it makes it a lot easier. So if you go to cardkingdom.com/commandzone when you're ordering all the cards for your Urza deck, or maybe you've seen another legendary creature, we don't know which ones have been revealed yet, from Modern Horizons, we really do appreciate everybody that uses that affiliate link. They help us with game nights, extra turns, this podcast, all of our content.
And so does Ultra Pro. Obviously, we have these cool playmats that we will be giving away soon.
Oh, yeah, we have the anime-style playmats. I forgot to call it out.
Super cool. They had alternate art.
Oh, that one is sweet.
Yeah, Soren. So they created alternate art for if you have a 50% chance of opening a Japanese pack and getting an alternate art Planeswalker. Or each time a Planeswalker shows up, you have a 50% chance of it being...
Only in Japanese booster packs.
But yeah, these playmats are awesome. Thank you, Ultra Pro, for sponsoring the show as well. All right, let's move on to the end set, where we're talking about something cool outside the world of Magic. You wrote this down. I'm excited. The next season's coming out, right?
Yeah, so June 5th, the new season of Handmaid's Tale.
June, a very fitting name.
Yeah.
Fitting month for the show.
It's the third season, and I did want to mention it ahead of time because I wanted everybody to have a chance to go to Hulu. It's on Hulu. And... binge through the first two seasons so you can catch up and watch on season three. Because I think, I'm going to say this statement, and I think it's true for me right now. I think this is the best television show, quote unquote, that exists right now.
It's definitely better than Game of Thrones currently.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. It's, I mean, yeah, I think I will stand by that statement. For me, anyway, it's my favorite TV show. I say that in quotes because obviously it's streaming. It's on Hulu. Right now, it's very, very good. The acting, the writing's really good. It's shot beautifully.
Yeah, the cinematography is great.
Yeah,
it's also a incredibly depressing and sad show, and very dramatic. It's not like a cheery thing to watch, but for that, I usually tend to stray away from those kinds of shows. I found myself sucked more and more into it because of all the parts of the production are so well done, and the story itself feels very relevant and very pertinent as well to just modern day.
It's definitely a poignant story, and yeah, it's great. I would just recommend it highly to anybody who wants to check out a really good TV show.
Handmaid's Tale.
But yes, for those that listen to this podcast or watch it with your children, it's probably not appropriate. It's like
not
Game of Thrones.
Kid. Yeah,
it's like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, yeah. The Lord opens.
Actually, it's not even like Game of Thrones. It's a little like Game of Thrones.
Blessed
but
be the Father.
I'd say Blessed I would be less say. Inclined to let like my teenager or younger watch it than I would Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I would actually, you know, I would say if I had to choose one of the two, Game of Thrones if they want to be involved in pop culture, Handmaid's Tale if they want more thought experiments or stuff. Because it is definitely, because Game of Thrones is, at the end of the day, it's not like...
No, I'm saying I would not allow anybody that's like, if they were my teenager or younger, to even watch Handmaid's Tale, where I would consider Game of Thrones.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in recent seasons, Game of Thrones got way less...
that's true. Nudie?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Way less nudie.
Way less nudie.
Something else that is not nudie at all is the Masters of Modern Podcast, our sister podcast. That's how they like to be described, by the way.
Hi, it's Alex Cousin, Ben Bateman. We are not nude today.
So those two guys, they really know the modern format. And of course, our preview card, Urza, is from Modern Horizons, has a ton of new cards that have never existed in modern before. So I'm sure those guys are going to be breaking down exactly which ones are going to fit into which decks or create new archetypes or,
very
you know,
exciting.
All that kind of stuff. So I'm sure they're super stoked about it. You can find them on Twitter at the MMcast. You can go to YouTube, just type Masters of Modern into the search bar, or you can go to collected.company and they are right next to us.
Yeah, at the MMcast. Good guys. They're going to be having a blast with this next season.
They got to be going crazy. That's like when Commander product comes out for us. This is that for them.
Yeah, but this is the first time it's ever happened.
Yeah, exactly. I feel bad because we get that every year.
I know, right? Our editor for the show is Jared Lafreniere. And special thanks to Jeffrey Palmer as well, who makes the Living Card animations behind us. And as well, in front and ending the videos on youtube.com/TheCommandZonePodcast. You can find Jeffrey at LivingCardsMTG on Twitter.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching.
And we'll see you next time.
Peace.
For your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.
you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.